This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's FIFA and Cafe reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Alicia Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Corvallis hosts a Mother's Day vigil Sunday at the National Guard Armory.
Diebold Corporation faces new accusations that their voting machines are easily hacked.
200,000 AK-47 machine guns have been lost in transport to Iraq.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,436 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 wounded. In Iraq, some experts estimate that true civilian body count is as high as 250,000 Iraqis dead. Meanwhile, a new Harris poll places President Bush's approval rating at an historic low, 29%.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 12, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. A Beaverton man has sued telephone company Verizon Northwest today for $1 billion. Daryl Hines charges the utility gave over millions of his customers' telephone records to the National Security Agency without a warrant. Hines said in court papers that Verizon Northwest provided that information to the NSA without previously consulting its customers, obtaining permission, or even advising its customers after the fact. The plaintiff's lawyer also asked for the case to be expanded to a class action to cover all Verizon customers in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California.
The city of Eugene has dropped its attempt to reinstate a trespassing charge against a woman ejected from a 2004 rally for shouting during a speech by Vice President Dick Cheney. The move brings to a close the case against 56-year-old Perry Saunders Patterson. The Eugene woman was arrested in September 2004 at the Eugene airport. She had been ejected in the hangar after she shouted, "No, no, no," when Cheney said President Bush and the war in Iraq had made the world a safer place.
It's not too late to catch the last of the Willamette Valley's scheduled Mother's Day peace and justice events. A coalition of human rights advocates last weekend held a conference on globalization and mothers in Portland. Today, Code Pink held a Mother's Day march through downtown Portland in which women pushing shopping carts demanded a refund on the cost of the U.S. war on Iraq, many holding cash register receipts. And in Corvallis, this Sunday, March 14, a coalition of 10 peace groups will hold a march and vigil for peace and truth in recruiting at 1 p.m., leaving Cloverland Park at the corner of 29th and Garfield to the National Guard Armory at 1100 Kings Boulevard. A 24-hour vigil at the armory starts at 2 p.m. in the National Guard. A sergeant is slated to speak. Organizer Michelle Darr of Corvallis Alternatives to War and Corvallis Code Pink will read Julia Ward Howe's original Mother's Day proclamation issued in 1870 after Howe's experience as a nurse in the Civil War. Lisa Loving has more.
From the voice of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, "Disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe our dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after his own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a General Congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and the earliest period consistent with its objects to promote the alliance of the different nationalities the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace. Julia Ward Howe, 1870.
You rock, Miss Michelle.
Thank you.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with organizer Michelle Darr of Corvallis Alternatives to War and Corvallis Code Pink. For more information, call 541-738-0658.
For his senior project, Redmond High School student John Hayes organized a protest against senior projects. He wrote a research paper, collected 88 student signatures, and organized a protest yesterday outside school district headquarters. Hayes says he studied nonviolent protest for his project and learned that one person can make a difference. Hayes wants the school district to loosen deadlines and remove a 50-hour work requirement on the project, which is a requirement for graduation. Many districts have been requiring senior projects, and they'll become a statewide requirement for the class of 2008. A Lake Washington School District spokeswoman, Catherine Reith, says the project is an opportunity for students to public career, as the district is taking Hayes' suggestions.
The Dunes, Oregon City Council, on a vote last night, opted to call a temporary halt development. That moratorium will initially last 120 days, but Mayor Sheldon Meyer cast the tie-breaking vote. One reason to stop development was to keep faith in that had become very active. Meyer says Dune City will have to rely on involvement to come up with protections for water quality in Wohink and Siltkoos Lakes. That's the source of drinking water for nearly all of the city's 1,200 residents. Work on protecting water quality has already begun. The council recently adopted a tougher ordinance regulating existing septic systems, and there's also talk of banning phosphorus-based fertilizers. Liam?
The U.S. Coast Guard is checking out what it calls a mystery sheen on the Willamette River this morning. Observers on the bank under the Burnside Bridge called it some kind of oil spill. Strangely, Coast Guard Lieutenant Michael Block says it's not an oil slick or spill. He says it's a light petroleum-based sheen. He says city, state, and federal agencies are involved. Block says the source is unknown, and he can't estimate the volume of the substance.
The Secretary of State in Washington says he has deleted 55,000 illegal voter registrations from the new statewide database. The total includes more than 35,000 duplicate voter records and more than 19,000 entries for dead people. Secretary of State Sam Reed says he suspects very few people double voted. He says in most cases, voters simply moved and didn't get their old registration canceled. The statewide voter database holds records for 3.3 million active Washington voters and about 405,000 inactive voters.
Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems, which has been criticized for faulty electronic voting machines, faces new accusations by computer security experts that the integrity of the machines could be easily compromised. From Ohio, FSRN's Quinn Bowman has more.
The electronic voting machine manufacturer, whose former chief executive promised an electoral victory for President Bush, is again facing serious criticism. Several computer science experts who have studied Diebold election systems voting machines warn that the electronic systems are wide open to tampering attempts. Finnish computer expert Harry Hursti recently discovered a new security problem with Diebold systems while working for Black Box Voting, a nonprofit company that works to ensure fair elections. Diebold says the security hole was left intentionally by programmers so that the system software could be easily updated. Experts who have studied the flaw say that anyone with simple computer components and access to the machines could tamper with the systems without leaving a trace. Bradblog.com, a site dedicated to electronic voting issues, reports that the flawed touchscreen machines were used just 2 weeks ago in Ohio's primary election. Several states, including Ohio, Pennsylvania, California, and Iowa, use the Canton, Ohio-based company's machines. Reading for Quinn Bauman in Athens, Ohio, I'm Antonio Ortiz for FSRN.
In breaking news, truthout.org investigative reporter Jason Leopold reports today an anonymous source has revealed Karl Rove believes he will soon be indicted. Leopold reports Rove told George W. Bush and other high-level administration officials within the last week that he will be indicted in the CIA leak case. The source indicated Rove will immediately resign his White House job when the special counsel publicly announces the charges against him. Rove is said to have told Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton that he will be charged with perjury regarding how and when he discovered that covert CIA operative Valerie Plame Wilson worked for the agency and whether he discussed her job with reporters. Sources close to the case said there is a strong chance Rove will also face an additional charge of obstruction of justice.
The Defense Department's accounting practices are in such disarray that defense officials can't track how much equipment the military owns, where it all is, or exactly how they spend defense dollars every year, according to a report yesterday by a non-governmental group. The report by Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities called the Pentagon's financial management practices an embarrassment that wouldn't pass muster in the private sector. The nonpartisan group, made up of more than 600 current and retired business executives from U.S. companies, thinks that federal spending priorities are undermining national security. The group wants Congress to shift money from the defense budget to spend more on schools, health care, energy independence, deficit reduction, and other programs. The United States plans to spend $441 billion on defense this year, excluding war costs, which are expected to top $120 billion in 2006.
The United States has again refused the International Committee of the Red Cross access to terrorism suspects held in secret detention centers, the humanitarian agency said today. The overnight statement was issued after talks in Washington between ICRC President Jacob Kellenberger and senior officials, including Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. The former senior Swiss diplomat said that the ICRC would continue to seek access to such people as a matter of priority.
Federal agents searched the home and offices of the CIA's departing number 3 official today as part of a corruption investigation that has sent a former congressman to prison and now involves CIA contracts. Investigators from 5 federal agencies acted under search warrants at the home of Kyle Dusty Fago in Vienna, Virginia, and his office at the CIA's Langley, Virginia campus. The warrants themselves were sealed and officials would not discuss what agents were seeking. Fago agreed to step down as the CIA's executive officer under pressure because federal authorities are investigating whether he improperly awarded contracts to San Diego businessman and friend Brent Wilkes, according to federal law enforcement and intelligence officials. Prosecutors have implicated Wilkes in a scheme to bribe former Representative Randy Duke Cunningham, Republican of California.
The congressional debate on immigration is expected to resume in the Senate on Monday. After political wrangling, Democrats and Republicans have agreed on how to proceed with the legislation. Meanwhile, the Minutemen, an anti-immigrant vigilante group, has converged on Capitol Hill, voicing staunch opposition to the Senate bill and undocumented immigrants. As FSRN's Lee and Caldwell reports, immigrant rights advocates countered their claims.
The Senate will use the Hagel-Martinez version of the immigration bill as the base legislation. It was the latest compromise brokered by the Senate before negotiations broke down 1 month ago. This bill creates a 3-tiered system based on how long an immigrant has resided in the U.S. If under 2 years, they must return to their home country. A 2- to 4-year-long resident would have to re-enter the U.S. with a background check, fingerprints, and would be given a guest worker card. A resident for 5 years or more would receive lawful status and be able to apply for citizenship. Furthermore, it would increase the number of work visas from the current level of 80,000 to 400,000. Republican Senator Mel Martinez from Florida, one of the authors, said this bill will also focus on security.
We're going to add Border Patrol agents. We're going to add immigration enforcement investigators, immigration inspectors, customs inspectors. We're going to authorize the Department of Homeland Security to make whatever improvements they need on the border in terms of the checkpoints, in terms of the virtual fencing, the kind of stuff that may, in this day and time, allow us to have surveillance over the border and be able to react appropriately.
$2 billion for border security has already been pledged in the emergency supplemental that passed the Senate last week. A handful of core Republicans are likely to voice strong opposition to Hagel-Martinez and will attempt to strip the legislation of its citizenship provisions. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama.
We basically, in this legislation, create an entitlement to let people who are non-citizens of the country decide how many are going to come in without this nation making those decisions.
President Bush will address the nation during prime time on Monday to urge Congress to pass a guest worker program. It is being reported that the administration is working on a plan to deploy the National Guard to the U.S. border to enforce security. The House of Representatives authorized funding for this yesterday in a larger defense spending bill. Meanwhile, outside the Capitol, 50 Minutemen draped in American flags held signs, chanted, cheered, and listened to a series of speakers denouncing immigrants as criminals and politicians as corrupt. Meanwhile, immigrant rights groups denounced the Minutemen. The two groups stood 50 yards from each other, separated by yellow police tape and 20 Capitol Police officers. Tarek Khan is a counter-protester who lives in Northern Virginia, where Minutemen stake out day laborer sites.
We need cultural change in this country. We need institutional change. This isn't something that will be fixed by just a new law.
Hearing the counter-protest, the Minutemen responded.
Go to hell! The multi-ethnic Minuteman Project will survive with or without you racist scum. Now get out of my face. I'm tired of hearing from you.
The Minutemen support H.R. 4437, the immigration legislation that passed the House that makes felons of undocumented immigrants. Whichever version passes the Senate, it will have to be met with that House version. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And the AP is reporting at this hour that President Bush is considering plans to shore up the Mexican border with National Guard troops paid for by the federal government, according to senior administration officials. One defense official said military leaders believe the number of troops required could range from 3,500 to 10,000, depending on the final plan. Another administration official cautioned that the 10,000 figure was too high. The officials insisted on anonymity since no decision has been announced. Democrats in Congress today asked how many National Guard troops might be deployed, for how long, and at what cost to the taxpayers, as well as the problem of possible disruption of upcoming deployments to Iraq and elsewhere overseas. The president is expected to reveal his plans in an address next Monday at 5 o'clock. And now it's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Thanks to Grover Norquist, the Republican lobbyist and right-wing anti-government guru, the world has just gotten weirder. Along with Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay, Grover developed the K Street Project in the 1990s. It was an effort to require corporate lobbying firms, which are mostly headquartered along Washington's K Street, to hire partisan Republicans as their lobbyists and to give the preponderance of their campaign donations to the GOP. The unwritten quid pro quo of the project was that corporations that played this game of footsie could expect a friendly reception for their legislative agenda. As you might expect, this quickly devolved into a system of thinly veiled bribery, with lawmakers trading legislative favors for lobbyist cash. Thus, the term K Street Project has now become a political pejorative, an iconic brand name for big money corruption in Washington. This negative PR for his pet project has mightily upset Norquist, so he is trying to trademark the phrase K Street Project, and he says he'll sue the pants off anyone who uses it as a symbol of unethical behavior. And you thought Republicans were opposed to frivolous lawsuits? No, they only oppose your lawsuits. As a group, corporate Republicans are the most litigious bunch in America. Maybe Grover could trademark Wall Street while he's at it, or Madison Avenue. Both have a negative connotation to much of the country, and Norquist could keep a whole circus of lawyers busy suing folks who speak badly of his trademarked streets. This is Jim Hightower saying, a fun-loving group called The Talent Show has suggested that Grover should use his trademark to market a line of appropriate products bearing the K Street Project logo, such as gold cufflinks, money clips, paper shredders, and, while he's at it, why not orange jumpsuits for the well-dressed lobbyist jail term? Let the weirdness flow. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Brad and Rose's special, Demystifying the Princess Paradigm. At 7, it's Essence of Soul with Shahid Hamid. And the weather? In both the Willamette Valley and in the Columbia Gorge, it will be getting warmer throughout the weekend with temperatures up to 80 degrees by Sunday. You are listening to the Cable Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The U.S. government has lost track of over 200,000 machine guns that were supposed to be used by the Iraqi police. The 99-ton cache of AK-47s was to have been secretly flown out from a U.S. base in Bosnia, but the four plane loads of arms have vanished. This development, along with the escape of five Iraqi inmates from a newly built high-security prison, is raising new questions about the competence of U.S. occupation forces. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
The human rights group Amnesty International says private arms brokers working for the Pentagon clandestinely shipped hundreds of thousands of weapons and tens of millions of rounds of ammunition from Bosnia to Iraq from July 2004 to June last year. In a new report out this week, Amnesty's arms control researcher Brian Wood says at least 200,000 Kalashnikovs destined for the Iraqi army never arrived.
This is irresponsible behavior.
By the time the machine guns disappeared, Wood says, they had already been through the hands of dubious private contractors from a half dozen countries.
The principal U.S. contracting firm had to use a broker in Croatia that was not known to the Croatian government at the time. They then used a freight forwarding agent in Bulgaria. They contracted a cargo company that broken the United Nations embargo on Liberia and also flew the weaponry out with aircraft that didn't have air operating authorization.
But while the Defense Department shipments to the Iraqi police never arrived, Iraqi army units are finding the fighters they capture increasingly well-equipped. Mohammed al-Mamouri is an interrogator with the Iraqi military's secret service.
The fighters have a lot of money. Their weapons are usually BKC automatic weapons. They have sniper guns and bombs. They have chemicals that can build bombs. They are spending a lot on buying them. We see most of the time that the weapons are brand new. We do not have this in Iraq.
In addition, American mistakes are complicating the job of Iraqi security forces. Five security detainees escaped from a high-security prison in northern Iraq Tuesday. Ironically, the prison had just been rebuilt by ECCI, a military contractor based in Burlingame, California. Prothap Chatterjee is managing director of the nonprofit CorpWatch and author of the book Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation. He recently visited a school ECCI rebuilt in northern Iraq. He's not surprised Iraqi prisoners broke through a wall and escaped.
When we went there, the school, the boys' dormitory looked very nice. It was painted yellow and red. But then the moment you walk around the back, you discovered there was no paint in the back. There was debris from the construction. You went upstairs. There was no water in the taps, and the sewage just flowed out on the east side and polluted the ground there. So I was intrigued by the fact that this company, ECCI from Burlingame, which had done a poor job of rebuilding schools, apparently also did a poor job of fixing this prison because five men broke out of it by finding a breach in the wall.
So far, the U.S. military hasn't caught the five escapees. Pentagon spokesperson told Reuters today they remain on the run. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
That's the KVU Evening News for Friday, May 12, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. You can send an email to pmnews@kvu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Noah Eaton and Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel, and on Sunday, let's include Mother Earth in our celebrations. Good night.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning at 7, here at the KBU Morning News. At 7:30, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey host More Talk Radio. They'll discuss alliances between African Americans and immigrants. Their guest will be Bruce Dixon, who's been writing about immigration issues for the Black Commentator. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, tune in to hear the moles digging among the hidden roots of polite society and exposing the foundations of wealth and power. At 10, it's the Food Show, which features a live interview with journalist and writer Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation. He'll discuss his new book, Chew On This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food, which presents the fast food industry to preteens. And at 11, Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Samuel Johnson said, "To be happy at home is the ultimate end of all ambition."
Spin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, big money and big corruption in Washington. It's not a news story, but a new book tries to tackle the latest scandals there. We'll speak to David Sirota about his book, Hostile Takeover, and about what kind of advice pundits will be giving the Democrats this election year. Also on Counterspin today, the breakup of the Knight Ridder newspaper chain may well result in Media News, a newspaper company owned by Dean Singleton, having something approaching a monopoly on San Francisco Bay Area newspapers. We'll talk to Tim Redman, the editor of the Bay Guardian, about Singleton and the outlook for Bay Area newspapers. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
On May 4th in Atlanta, something unusual happened. Donald Rumsfeld was asked a few tough questions, but it wasn't a reporter who was doing the asking. During a Q&A session, retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern asked Rumsfeld why he had claimed early in the Iraq War that he knew precisely where Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were, and that there was bulletproof evidence linking Iraq to Al-Qaeda. Rumsfeld initially denied making the WMD claim, but when McGovern quoted Rumsfeld's own words, it was, shall we say, an awkward moment. That was followed by another when Rumsfeld stammered over the phantom Al-Qaeda Iraq links question. It should have been an embarrassing moment for journalists, too. But rather than taking a lesson from McGovern's tough questions, many journalists tried to marginalize him and obscure the importance of the moment. Indeed, many television journalists lumped McGovern, who was called on to ask a question, in with the hecklers who were also present. CNN's Soledad O'Brien said Rumsfeld, quote, was heckled by opponents of the war in Iraq. Among them was Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, who asked him about previous claims weapons of mass destruction were in Iraq, close quote. CBS anchor Bob Schieffer announced that Rumsfeld, quote, ran head-on into hecklers that included a former CIA analyst, close quote. CBS reporter David Martin said that McGovern, quote, waited his turn to ask a question and then went for Rumsfeld's throat, close quote. Marginalizing McGovern was a media pattern with few exceptions. The fact that he was right and Rumsfeld was wrong was often overlooked. But was McGovern really going for Rumsfeld's throat, or was it that he was simply doing the job that journalists should have been doing these past years, and perhaps they forgot what it looked like?
The announcement that former NSA chief General Michael Hayden has been tapped to be the next CIA director was greeted by a front-page puff piece in the New York Times. The May 8th profile by Scott Shane was headlined, "Dodging Perils on Way to Top of Spy Game, General Earns Respect as Master of Briefing." The report described Hayden as brainy and quoted a source describing him as, quote, "knowing more about intelligence than anyone else," close quote. Elsewhere, Hayden was described as a sort of regular Joe from Pittsburgh, a Steelers fan, the son and brother of blue-collar workers, a man whose, quote, "clarity of thought and persuasive arguments," close quote, resulted from a parochial school education. But Hayden was anything but a master at a press briefing on January 23rd, where he was questioned by Knight Ridder reporter Jonathan Lande over the NSA's warrantless domestic spy program. There, Hayden demonstrated an ignorance of the Fourth Amendment, which outlaws unreasonable searches and seizures. Hayden wrongly denied that probable cause was the standard governing legal searches and seizures, and at one point denied that the probable cause term was even in the Fourth Amendment. This incident was not included in the Times profile, nor was any mention made of the fact that Hayden refused to answer whether or not the spy program was being used to target the White House's political opponents. To be fair, the Times was not alone in failing to include this information in news stories about Hayden. Well, this could be in part because journalists have decided the domestic spying program deserves media protection. This might explain why reporters regularly cherry-pick polling information to show public support for domestic spying when an accurate reading of the polls shows at least as many Americans are opposed to it. As writer Larry Beinhart pointed out on May 10th, quote, "If indeed General Hayden is a master of briefing, it is because the press, with the exception of Mr. Lande, lets him get away with so much," close quote.
CNN Reliable Sources host Howard Kurtz took a look at coverage of inflated gas prices on his May 7th show with three guests, Jerry Willis and Frank Sesno, both of CNN, and James Glassman, identified as representing American Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank. But that's not Glassman's only affiliation. Not disclosed on Kurtz's show was Glassman's job heading up the for-profit web journal TCS Daily, which counts ExxonMobil as one of its major financial sponsors. Glassman has a well-documented reputation as a pioneering journo-lobbyist, penning regular op-eds for mainstream papers supporting the interests of his sponsors, defending McDonald's against the criticisms levied against it in the film Supersize Me, for example, or attacking the use of generic anti-AIDS drugs in developing countries, which is a direct threat to the Pharmaceutical Trade Association, another of his sponsors. So while it's not surprising that Glassman would do as good a job as any official ExxonMobil spokesman, it is disturbing that the media continue to give him a platform, and a mighty welcoming one at that. In one exchange, Kurtz asked him, quote, "Are the media demonizing oil companies, Jim Glassman?" Close quote. Glassman's response was, "Absolutely, absolutely." One might hope that Kurtz would find a counterbalance to Glassman's gung-ho pro-industry stance, but Glassman's views were only amplified by CNN correspondent Frank Sesno, who suggested giving a Truth in Journalism Award to Chevron for its advertisements. Sesno also said he had a big beef with media coverage, quote, "We don't appropriately challenge conventional wisdom. Oh, conventional wisdom, the oil companies make too much money. Oh, conventional wisdom, conservation will solve everything," close quote. It's hard to say what media Sesno could possibly be watching where the conventional wisdom is that conservation will solve everything, but it's clearly not Howard Kurtz's show.
If you pay any attention to the complaints of mainstream media, you'll know that one thing they're angry about lately are blogs. The internet critics are many things, say reporters and pundits, obnoxious, impolite, and capable of massing what Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen dubbed a digital lynch mob to send furious emails. But other reporters at times acknowledge the obvious, that an army of fact-checkers and investigators can actually improve journalism. A May 4th report on NBC Nightly News attempted to make this point, but only illustrated one of the mainstream media's most consistent weaknesses, one that bloggers are constantly pointing out. NBC was trying to show that when George W. Bush came out against a Spanish-language version of the Star-Spangled Banner, there was some definite hypocrisy at play. As reporter Don Fratangelo said, quote, Bloggers pointed out that a book claims Mr. Bush once sang the anthem in Spanish. The White House responded, it was absurd, close quote. So there you have it. Newsworthy statement from the president, evidence to undermine that position, and then a denial from the White House. So who was right? Did the claims made in the unnamed book check out? Was there other evidence? NBC viewers sure don't know. It's the kind of he said, she said journalism that is regularly lampooned by bloggers and media critics. Ironic, then, to see it in a piece about blogs.
And finally, as we've discussed here on Counterspin before, the media like to tell us the economy's going great, but we're just too dumb to figure that out. It's a strange argument, but even stranger was a New York Times Week in Review piece on May 11th. Strange because it seemed to argue that the opposite was true. According to the Times, public opinion on the economy is rather strong. Quote, polls show that Americans are quite satisfied with today's overall economy, close quote. While that's at odds with what most polls show, and in fact, the Times just refers to one poll, their own, which most recently showed 57% of respondents rated the economy as either fairly good or very good. The point of the article was to show that both political parties are planning to use the economy in this election year. Democrats will argue that the benefits aren't being felt by most people. Republicans will cite strong numbers on growth, home ownership, and so on. To the Times, the trick for the White House is to figure out how to get some credit for people's positive attitudes toward the economy. But that CBS New York Times poll looks more like the exception than the rule. Similar surveys by other polling outfits like Pew, Gallup, and even Fox News show the public anxious and pessimistic about the state of the economy. A recent Pew poll found, for example, that 64% of respondents said the economy was fair or poor, while only 34% said it was excellent or good. Why the Times decided to base a front-page article on one outlying poll is puzzling, but is still more proof of the disconnect between the corporate press and the public when it comes to pocketbook issues.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
It's not news that big money knows how to flex its muscle in Washington. Lobbyists and corporate interests are known to have a heavy hand in everything from crafting legislation to their benefit to backing candidates, political parties, and so-called think tanks. But is the problem actually getting worse? And does all of this corruption have an effect on the strategy of the Democratic Party? In election seasons, pundits and political reporters advise the party to veer to the right to win. Where does that bad advice come from? We're joined now by the author of a new book on some of these very ideas. He's been called the kind of pundit you'd like to have on your side in a knife fight. His name is David Sirota. The book is called Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. David Sirota, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there's no shortage of books about corruption in government, of course, but there are certainly times when this issue is more relevant, like now, for example. What does your book tell us about how things work in Washington?
Well, what the book basically says is that corruption is far more than Tom DeLay, Duke Cunningham, the bribery scandals, Jack Abramoff. That corruption has been too narrowly defined, that really what corruption is the artificial narrowing of the political debate by politicians and pundits to make sure that the policy outcomes of those debates are only those that do not challenge big money interests. So as just one example, when we think about the energy debate that's been going on in this country, mostly the debate in Washington has been a debate between which tax breaks to give to which oil companies. It has not been a debate that includes things like a windfall profits tax, a federal price gouging law, better FTC enforcement of consolidation in the energy industry. Why? Because the latter suggestions that I put out there are those that would challenge big money interests. Tax breaks for oil companies. The oil companies don't need to buy votes. They don't need to bribe people. If the debate is that between those tax breaks, then the policy outcome will automatically benefit the oil companies. That is corruption.
And it's sort of business as usual. I guess that's one of the frustrations with news coverage. It comes and goes. Jack Abramoff becomes a household name. Congress takes up some kind of reform of their ethics. The issue goes away. Problem is solved, apparently. What other frustrations do you see in how the press handles what should be a regular beat for any newspaper in Washington?
the problem is that corruption has become so mundane that legalized bribery, if you will, has become so mundane that reporters barely bat an eye when the worst kinds of things happen. So campaign contributions go in, for instance, from the drug companies, and a $1 trillion Medicare bill that has no drug price controls at all in it comes out, a massive giveaway to the drug companies. The corruption that happened there is never front and center in the media coverage because it's expected. That's essentially how things work. That's how reporters accept things as working in our quote-unquote democracy.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about narrowing the debate. We'd like to address a version of that. It's a pretty consistent phenomenon as it goes with the Democratic Party. You hear pundits and reporters cautioning the Democrats in an election year, stick to the center. That's how you win elections. You've written about this. It's a constant frustration. What's the usual advice from the pundits, and where does it go wrong, do you think?
The usual advice is to stick to the center, but the center in the pundit class and in Washington is a far to the right position than the average American center. So center in Washington and in the pundit class means, for instance, supporting free trade deals that undermine Americans' wages, our jobs, our health care benefits, etc. That's a centrist, quote-unquote, pro-business position, even though polls show most Americans have serious doubts about those free trade policies, even though those free trade policies have destroyed many small and medium-sized businesses. It's still called pro-business. So what really is going on is an artificial distortion of the actual concept of the center. The distortion is designed to make sure, again, that the policy outcomes and that the positions advocated by, in this case, the Democratic Party, are those that never truly challenge big money interests. So if you're wondering why government doesn't work to solve problems, people should realize government can't solve problems if it refuses to challenge the big money interests at the center of those problems.
You write about several of these pundits. One of them most recently, Peter Beinart, most famous as an editor at the New Republic, will have a new book coming out challenging the Democrats again to move further right. What's interesting about Beinart that you pointed out is that people like him face no consequences for their advice. They can be wrong and wrong over and over again, and there isn't a mechanism to say, your advice has led people down the wrong path time and time again.
It's perhaps worse, actually. I mean, in Beinart's case, it's just an example. Here's a guy who laid the intellectual and media groundwork to get Democrats to support the Iraq war, the key support that got Congress on board for that war. He now is publishing a book purporting to be an expert on foreign policy, demanding more strength, quote-unquote, and consistency from the Democratic Party. We're expected to simply forget, A, about the disastrous behavior and consequences from him in terms of the Iraq war. We're also expected to forget that, as a throwaway line, if you do a LexisNexis search, that he now says he was wrong. We're just sort of supposed to just throw that away. We're supposed to accept him as a foreign policy expert, a guru, who can actually preach to the Democratic Party, even though, he just sort of throws it away. I was wrong. But that's okay. He can still be an expert. That is entirely unacceptable. It explains a lot on issue after issue, on pundit after pundit, how there are no consequences, and thus being no consequences, we get the wholly disconnected policies that are, again, disconnected from what mainstream America actually wants.
Now, finally, I was wondering about this and listening to you speak. You're talking about the narrowing of the debate in government and in policy circles, and we're also talking about the narrowing of the debate in the media. Are the two related? Does the corruption in Washington sort of feed this phenomenon in the media, do you think?
I absolutely do. I mean, reporters will tell you they just cover what the politicians say, but I don't agree with that. I think it's partially true. And a lot of politicians, as I argue in the book, are artificially narrowing the debate. But what the media does is marginalize those voices outside of the consensus positions. That is, so for instance, on universal health care, it's a 60 to 70% supported issue in the public. It's barely talked about in the political system. When it is, and here's the key thing that the media does, when it is, the person pushing it is billed as some sort of lunatic. They're billed as some sort of out-of-the-mainstream voice by the media. So it is a joint operation here to marginalize voices who actually speak for the vast majority of Americans.
You came into the studio brandishing a media site. It's a David Brooks column from May 11th where he writes that the pseudo-populist renegades who rail against the establishment are being eclipsed by the canny establishmentarians. It's almost as if people in the media like Brooks, and he's certainly not the only one, are more invested in the status quo and the establishment, in the political establishment, than they are in anything else.
That's absolutely true, and in many ways it's a rational decision. Folks like David Brooks and these pundits and these politicians have succeeded and ascended to prominence within the status quo. The corporate interests that are backing those politicians, that are backing those think tanks, that help promote people, writers like David Brooks, they are financially benefiting from the status quo. They are reaping billions of dollars from a government that has totally been bought off.
We've been speaking with David Sirota. You can find him online at davidsirota.com. The book is called Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. It is in stores now. David Sirota, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
The buying and selling of newspapers in the impending breakup of the former Knight Ridder newspaper chain has resulted in a tentative deal that would leave Dean Singleton's company, Media News Group, with near-hegemonic control of San Francisco Bay Area newspapers. With us to talk about Dean Singleton and the Bay Area newspaper scene, as well as the prospect of living in a non-competitive newspaper region, is Tim Redmond, the executive editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Redmond's May 3rd editorial, Stop Singleton's Media Grab, can be read on the Guardian's website at www.sfbg.com. Welcome to Counterspin, Tim Redmond.
Glad to be here.
Well, could you set the scene up for us? Tell us what Bay Area newspaper ownership will look like if the Singleton deal goes through.
If this deal goes through, every significant daily newspaper in the entire Bay Area will be owned by one company, that's Media News Group, except for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, way up north, 50 miles north in Santa Rosa, and the San Francisco Chronicle in San Francisco, which is also in an odd kind of way a part of this deal. So essentially, we could be looking at a situation where one company or company and partners controlled every daily newspaper in the entire Bay Area.
Well, there's a weekly newspaper scene, too. What will that look like?
Media News Group has also bought a large number, about 30 community small-town dailies and weeklies. So the number of newspapers that they're going to own around the Bay Area is absolutely staggering.
Well, I want to tell listeners that there's a very nice map there at the sfbg.com website composed by the San Jose Newspaper Guild that accompanies your editorial and that shows how Singleton really will control an awful lot of Bay Area print media. Well, tell us about Dean Singleton and his company. Tim Redmond, tell us about Media News Group.
Well, Dean Singleton is known as Lean Dean, and for very good reason. He has this philosophy that he has pioneered called clustering. And the idea is he tries to buy up newspapers in adjoining geographic regions. So he'll have the newspaper in town A, and then he'll buy the newspaper in town B next door, and then the newspaper in town C, and then the newspaper in town D, so that he owns all the media in a geographic area. That, of course, allows him to centralize printing, centralize management, and also centralize news gathering, because it's possible to have a team of reporters in one town covering the three towns around there. And, of course, what that means is you can cut costs phenomenally. And for the likes of Dean Singleton, cutting costs generally means laying off reporters, particularly investigative reporters and people who cost a little more money. So he's known as a rather aggressive cost cutter.
Well, at the Oakland Tribune, didn't he, after he took over that some years ago, he made very heavy cuts from 630 employees down to 280.
Yes, he more than cut the staff in half. And that's I think, what we'll see if this deal ends up going through.
Is there any concern in the Bay Area, one of the most liberal areas in the country, that Singleton, who will have so much media power there, is a Republican contributor and a close friend of both Bush's father and son?
Well, of course there's a concern. And I'll tell you, I complain about newspaper chains a lot. But as chains go, Knight Ridder, which has sold some of its publications to now Dean Singleton, was pretty good on the war. I mean, the Knight Ridder papers were generally critical of the invasion of Iraq and generally called for an end to the war. We're not going to see that out of Dean Singleton. And, of course, more important than the fact that it's a conservative voice, what we're going to see is a unitary voice. Other than, you know, the Santa Rosa Press Democrat way up north and the San Francisco Examiner, which is a small free daily in San Francisco, all of the editorials in all of the newspapers are going to reflect Dean Singleton's philosophy on local endorsements, congressional endorsements, Senate endorsements, national endorsements, and national politics.
So not only will editorials be written out of a virtual central office, but news as well.
Well, I fear what I see going on down the road is Singleton combining all news-gathering operations in one office, maybe in San Francisco, maybe in San Jose, having one newsroom, and trying to cover the entire Bay Area from there. And it would be cheap. You'd basically only be paying one staff of reporters in one office and only maintaining one newsroom. And then you'd have people on the phone calling the cops in some of these other towns and calling around and doing an occasional story and driving up for an occasional city council meeting when there's something volatile on the agenda. But you won't have the kind of beat reporting that a daily newspaper in a town or city ought to have, where you got a couple of people who wander over to City Hall every day to watch what's going on, to see where the mayor's, who the mayor's meeting with and what's going on, to sit in all of the different meetings, to really pay attention to community news. And I'm afraid that's one of the things that we're going to lose.
Tim Redman, the Hearst Company, which owns the San Francisco Chronicle, and which one would think would be in fierce competition with media news, is playing a very strange role in this deal. Tell us about that.
Well, it is a very strange role. And, you know, you think about it, what happened is, Hearst Corporation is buying several of the newspapers, essentially for Dean Singleton. Hearst is buying a couple of papers, and then immediately, not in San Francisco, they're buying a paper in Monterey and a paper in St. Paul, Minnesota, and then immediately selling them back to Singleton in exchange for a stake in Singleton's business outside of the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, why are they doing that? Is it that Dean Singleton, a large media baron, was unable to get enough bank financing to pull through this deal, so he needed Hearst to help out? I don't think so. I think the reason he did it was Hearst was potentially his biggest competitor, potentially the only outfit that could complain about and try to stop this deal as a major newspaper, a major company. So why not bring them on board? Why fight when you can work together? So Hearst Corporation now has a stake in Singleton's success, although not directly in the Bay Area. How hard are they going to fight to compete against this? Before long, we may see a joint operating agreement or some other arrangement where the Hearst paper in San Francisco, the Chronicle, which, by the way, is losing a ton of money and losing circulation fast, somehow gets merged into the Singleton chain. I think that's the end game.
Well, considering that media landscape, the San Francisco Bay Guardian will be one of the few independent weeklies or any kind of newspaper in the area holding the line. What's that going to be like?
We will be virtually the only independent newspaper in San Francisco or around here. It's going to be a challenge, but it's already a challenge. I mean, we're up against a chain-owned weekly competitor out of Phoenix, New Times Media, which just merged with Village Voice Media. They're a vicious anti-competitive chain competitor that we're facing now. And, you know, we're looking at the Bay Area now. We've got Hearst Corporation out of New York. We've got Singleton out of Denver. The Examiner is owned by Ann Schultz out of Denver. I mean, there's no locally owned media in San Francisco anymore. We're about it.
We've been speaking with Tim Redmond. He's the executive editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. His Stop the Singleton Media Grab editorial can be read online at the paper's website at www.sfbg.com. Tim Redmond, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. Again, that's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart and myself, Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 12th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. There's been a breakthrough in the on-again, off-again negotiations between the state of Wisconsin and the Ho-Chunk tribe over unpaid casino fees. Gil Halstead from Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The Ho-Chunk have agreed to pay the state $30 million in back payments dating back to 2004. That's when the state Supreme Court invalidated Governor Doyle's compact with the Potawatomi tribe because it included expanded table games at their casino. The Ho-Chunk decided not to add new games and refused to make compact payments until the state agreed to a longer compact term. State Department of Administration spokesperson Sean Dilwig called this week's move by the Ho-Chunk a goodwill gesture. He called it a down payment towards an agreement on the full $105 million the state expects the tribe to pay.
We are working to find a settlement that still provides them the security of a decent length of term, but also provides the state with a stable funding source.
The state reached a 25-year compact agreement with the Potawatomi last year and is seeking a similar length for the Ho-Chunk. Dilwig says the issue of expanded games will be decided in the federal courts. He adds that both the state and all the tribes are anxiously awaiting a state Supreme Court ruling on the Dairyland lawsuit. That suit seeks to make all tribal gaming illegal unless the state also allows non-tribal casinos. He says that puts a damper on the tribe's plans to expand their casinos and on the state's effort to increase casino fees.
I think when we contemplated some of the payments, we expected expanded games to be in place at existing casinos, but a lot of tribes are holding back, waiting until the Dairyland decision is resolved.
The court is expected to rule on the Dairyland lawsuit sometime in June. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
Over the past week, a Navajo mother-daughter team of poets from New Mexico has been sharing the spotlight with luminaries like Desmond Tutu and Walter Cronkite at the second Quest for Global Healing conference in Bali. Reporter Eric Mack caught up with the pair at a reading just before they left and files this story.
I was walking into the sunshine when corporate masses overwhelm my freedom. Every time I turn around, billboard confronts me. Red cursive letters spell out my addiction, Coca-Cola. Penelope Cruz...
16-year-old Lila Johnston is busy these days. Just before making her first trip outside the country to be the youngest presenter scheduled at the Global Healing Conference, she could be seen in New York at a national poetry slam a week earlier. She says that her poetry and the conference in Bali are inspired by the same sense of purpose.
It's just all this amazing stuff like sustainability, not only that, but women's rights. That's how it coincides with my writings, because I really write to make a difference, and I didn't really do that intentionally. It just kind of happens that way.
Johnston and her mother, Pat McCabe, are teaching writing workshops at the conference. McCabe says that although she and her daughter have very different styles of writing and performing, they will both be drawing on shared beliefs.
What we've agreed on is trying to find one of our common points, which actually happens to be in large part our spiritual practice. I mean, we're not really actually going to be doing a spiritual ceremony necessarily there, but we're going to be talking a little bit about that background and inviting other people to try out some of the principles that are involved. For instance, talking circle, and then we're going to bring in the written aspect to talking circle.
My song just keeps rising in the face of jets drawing fear in railroads in the sky. Songs that our children hear as fairy tales about a time when the people knew the earth.
My mother's full-blood Dene Navajo, and I'm half, so we're going to be the only Native American speakers there that we know of. So we're really representing the indigenous people of America who do need to be represented.
Lila and her mother will be heading back from Bali later this week to share their experiences with folks here at home. I'm Eric Mack in Taos.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.